Welcome to 2819. This is the show where we aim to inspire you to make disciples of all nations. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rombacher, and this is a television outreach of Reasons to Believe, a viewer-supported ministry where science and faith converge.
And you know, it's everyone's favorite time of year. It's Christmas time. So we want to just thank our viewers and our listeners and give you a big thank you for just supporting our show.
And it's people like you that make resources like this show possible.
And if you'd like to support resources like this show, visit reasons.org/2819.
And for all of you watching on YouTube, make sure you hit that subscribe button below. Stay up to date on all the new videos RTB is making.
You can also connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at 2819 Show. We'd love to hear from you.
And if you want just the audio from 2819, you can get the podcast version of the show. It's on Apple Podcasts and Google Play. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
Well, I think it's about that time
for a rundown.
In our Nexus segment, Paul Copan will talk about the question, is truth relative? So relevant to today's culture.
Definitely. And in RTB 101, Crystal will be talking with Hugh Ross asking, are the Bible's long lifespans scientifically possible?
That's a common.
Yeah, it's very relevant too, because it comes up every time we talk about that.
Yeah. In our Give and Take segment, Fazal Rana will join Jeff Zwierink, and they'll talk about the question, were Neanderthals human?
And if you think like me, you're going to love the Culture Talk segment. Sandra, we talk with Fazal Rana asking the question about connecting faith to comic book story arcs.
Let's check that out. Welcome to Culture Talk. This is the segment where we talk about the intersection of science, faith, and pop culture and how culturally relevant topics can be used to start conversations about your faith. I'm joined today with Dr. Fazal Rana. You're a biochemist and a comic book nerd.
I am.
Right?
Yeah, I am.
Same here. You know, we love comics, and a lot of times people think, you know, for Christians, it doesn't really make sense how we can connect that to our faith. Yeah. It's just a hobby, but for us, it's not, right?
Yeah. I think comics are a profound expression of the human condition, and mm-hmm. so I see all kinds of connection points between comic book story arcs and the Christian faith.
Totally, yeah, same here. I mean, some of the ones that I love, when I think of The Watchmen, I mean, that one's just so dark, but, yeah. You know, it helps us to kind of understand the brokenness of the world. And what are some of yours that...
Well, one comic book that I've read recently that I found to be really interesting is the infamous Iron Man story arc, and it's featuring Dr. Doom, who's one of my favorite supervillains in the mm-hmm. Marvel Universe. He's the arch nemesis of the Fantastic Four, and he turns out to go from a supervillain into a superhero because he attains everything that he wants as a supervillain and finds it dissatisfying, mm-hmm. and he realizes that true meaning is only going to be found in actually helping people and actually being a hero and doing good. So it's an interesting story of redemption of sorts.
And you touch on such a wonderful point, because you do see redemption in comics and in books and films. One of the kind of infamous ones is with Darth Vader, yeah. and you see him being redeemed, not because he realizes that it's in helping people that he finds value, but I mean, that is what he ends up doing, but it's really in his son believing that there's still good in him, and that motivates him to change and to do good. And of course, he dies right at the end, spoiler, but, you know, it's something that we see, and it's very prevalent in comics and in stories in general, that you see these kind of story arcs of redemption. Yeah. And so just share a little bit more about how you connect that then, kind of on a personal level.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to me, you know, the whole idea of a redemptive story arc is somebody that's broken, that's incomplete, that's flawed, mm-hmm. that's bad, becomes good, becomes whole, becomes complete, they grow. And I think we all see in ourselves in those characters that are broken and bad, because we know that we are that way ourselves, right. and yet we know that there's also good in us, and that we see good in those characters. Mm-hmm. And so when we see that person go away from bad to good, it's something that we desire ourselves as human beings. And it's a yearning, I think, we all have for redemption.
Right. And you know what I love about the idea of comics in particular? You know, they're set in these fantastic worlds. So we're able to detach ourselves enough to let those stories of redemption resonate without it being too preachy. Because if it were set in a natural world, we can kind of see right through it. But because we're dealing with people with superpowers and flying and other planets, it isn't as obvious, but yet it is able to strike a tone with people that they connect and it resonates with them.
Right.
And they feel the need to be redeemed.
Yeah. And that's, I think, the value of using comic books to build a bridge to our need for redemption, because they're not threatening.
Right.
To talk about these things is fun, it's non-threatening, but yet the themes, as you point out, are so powerful that it's a great way just to naturally segue into some deeper spiritual issues.
Right. And that's perfect, a perfect conversation to have during the holiday season, especially because we're reminded, as Christians, we're reminded of our need for redemption. So because we're Christians and we're engaging in this content, we don't just see, yes, that I'm broken and I do need redemption, but we see then where we get that redemption from.
Yeah.
So how would you step into that conversation?
Well, I mean, to me, it's this idea that as human beings, we bear God's image, and that's the good that's within us, but yet that good has been overwhelmed by sin, and that sin separates us from our Creator. But it's amazing to think that our Creator still sees that value in us and is willing now to rescue us, you know, to send the superhero in the form of Jesus, fully God and fully human, to sacrifice himself so that that good within us could be recovered and our relationship could be restored. And so that theme is again echoed in Dr. Doom's transformation and Darth Vader's transformation.
Yeah. And it really is beautiful to think then when we compare what's happening in these stories to what happens in the story of the Bible and the Christmas story of God stepping into our world and redeeming us and finding us worthy of redemption. It's just such a beautiful thing, and it does unfold in these comic books too. So
yeah, well, and if there's ever any question that a person feeling as if they lack value, that value is clearly demonstrated, I think, by the extent that God went to rescue us. And so God sees the good in us, and hopefully we can see the good in one another and reach out and try to recover that good fully.
Yeah, and it's such a good thing, I think, when we read these comics, to then be able to share that with others, you know, and that's one way to have kind of an open door to share our faith and talk about redemption in these stories and then what's available in Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us, Fuzz. If you want to hear more from Dr. Rana, visit reasons.org and check out the cells design. Now we're going to head to a clip from our AMP conference, and we're going to hear from Paul Copan about whether truth is relative. Let's check it out.
This notion of relativism is one that is pernicious. How many of you have had experiences talking with the true for you but not for me sorts of relativists? It's all a matter of perspective. It's all just opinion. That's just your interpretation. There is no such thing as knowledge. There is no such thing as truth for all people. It's simply what we happen to, you know, we just have different perspectives on this. And you could be, you know, I mean, yeah, you just have your view. In fact, I was on one campus, I was speaking, and there was one person who said to me during the Q&A time, he said, when people in the Middle Ages or whenever believed that the earth was flat, and this is a caricature of what actually took place in history, but when people believed that the earth was flat, that was true for them back then. I said, so for example, I said, well, what would happen if you got people who are starting to come around to believing that the earth is round? I wasn't, this conversation, I didn't plan it this way, but I'll just mention this whole idea of the earth being flat. There's a little pun in there for you. As I was speaking, I said, what about people who happen to be believing this, and you've got some people who believe it and some don't? Is it, you know, is it partially flat? Is it, you know, partially round? Is it flat for some people but round for others? You know, what's the situation here? I mean, it's kind of a silly sort of a thing that reality is somehow based on what I happen to be thinking about and nothing beyond my own mind. And this is what relativism really is, that truth is dependent upon my mind. It's dependent upon the constructs that I make up. Well, as JP mentioned, he said truth is a matchup, a correspondence between a statement or a story and the way things really are. Reality is the truth maker. It's sort of like betting on a horse. I'm not advocating this, by the way. But it's not because you bet on the horse that it's going to win. Your bet is successful only if the horse wins, if there is that matchup between the bet that you've made and the horse that wins. In the same way, reality is that truth maker.
If you'd like to watch Paul Kupan's talk in its entirety, please visit the Reasons to Believe YouTube channel and click on the AMP 2018 playlist. And now it's time for RTB 101. This is the segment where we train you to talk about your faith with friends and family more effectively. Now, the early chapters of Genesis describe people living hundreds of years. These lifespans almost sound fanciful or mythological, so I've asked Dr. Hugh Ross to come talk to us about this issue and answer the question, are long lifespans even scientifically possible?
Well, they are if you've got different physical conditions.
All right.
It's the physical conditions we have now that limit our lifespan.
All right, well, let's get into that. Let's start, though, with the Bible. Let's start with the early chapters of Genesis. What does the Bible say about these long lifespans? Like, how long were these people living?
800 to 900 years. Now, these are the few people that didn't get murdered by their fellow man. Those that died a natural death lived to be 969 years.
So he's before the flood, before Noah's
flood? Before the flood, right.
Okay. So they were living hundreds of years before the flood. But then something happens at the flood that shortens the lifespan of humans.
Well, you actually see that in the Genesis 11 genealogy, where the lifespans have an exponential decline down to the present maximum of about 120 years.
Okay. So something happens at the flood that God limits the lifespans? What is that?
Well, I think the fundamental story of these early chapters of Genesis looks what happens when people live a really long time. We all think that living a long time would be great. It's basically telling us we're better off only living 80, 90, 100 years.
Why is that?
Because that's a powerful tool to limit the multiplication of evil.
Oh.
For example, if you allow, a serial killer to live 900 years, they can kill off a lot of people.
I could see the problem there.
And explains why murder got out of control in the days before the flood. There wasn't that limitation to stop those kinds of evil acts.
So I'm imagining that some people might ask the question, how do you know that those years, those hundreds of years of lifespans were literal? Like, maybe that was just figurative or poetic.
Well, a lot of scholars look at this and say, you know, maybe we need to divide by a factor of 10 or a factor of 16. But if you do that, that means you've got these patriarchs having children when they're equivalent to 5 or 6 years old. And we know that's not biologically possible. So that's good evidence that from a biblical perspective, these lifespans really were 800 to 900 plus years.
So the view that we hold here at Reasons to Believe is when it says that someone lived 800, 900 years, that's
it's
literal.
Just like our years.
Just like our years.
Correct.
Okay, very good. Now, I can imagine that for some of my non-Christian friends, this would present a challenge or an obstacle to them taking the Bible seriously, like thinking about people living 800, 900 years. That just seems kind of odd or not scientifically plausible.
Well, I address this in a chapter in Navigating Genesis, basically making the point in the days before Noah's flood, there was a very different radiation environment for those people. Number one, they weren't exposed to the killer cosmic rays like we are today. A couple of astronomers I cite have basically documented there's been a single nearby supernova eruption that vastly increased the number of fast-moving heavy nuclei cosmic rays. Those are the ones that do you damage. And so people living before the flood wouldn't have been exposed to those killer cosmic rays, those after the flood would. The other thing we notice is that people before the flood were living in one locale. They weren't global yet, and they were living in a sedimentary plain, and their technology was not yet exploiting igneous rocks. Igneous rocks contain a lot of uranium and thorium. Today, everybody is exposed to those rocks. But in the days before the flood, you'd have humanity isolated from those rocks. So they weren't experiencing the damage from the radioactive decay of uranium and thorium. The other thing you notice, this is in the text, they're on a vegetarian diet. That's not an issue today, because you're not going to live long enough for it to make a difference. But if you're not on a vegetarian diet and you're living 800 or 900 years, you're going to die an earlier death from the accumulation of heavy metals in your body. And the last thing is, you need to have telomerase activity at a less aggressive rate. Your chromosomes get shorter and shorter as you get older and older, and that actually protects you from an earlier death from cancer. But if the cancer risk is not high because of the lack of radiation, you could have God build into our DNA a much less aggressive telomerase activity, which would actually allow people to live 800 or 900 years.
So you're speculating some different scientific conditions or conditions of the natural world.
And some of those conditions are not speculative. They're
okay.
Known.
All right.
Because we do know that there is this one supernova remnant that's responsible for these fast-moving heavy nuclei cosmic rays. We know it exploded somewhere between 20 and 100,000 years ago.
Okay.
There's a possibility that that event coincides with the flood of Noah, because the best day we got for Noah's flood is like 40,000 years ago, plus or minus 30,000 years. So if those two dates agree, we got a good concordance.
So if we think about some different physical conditions that might facilitate long lifespans.
Right.
And now we're even in an age where scientists are doing things to actually actively extend the life of humans by changing physical conditions. So that
True.
Seems sort of plausible.
True, but there is a limit. Because of our telomerase activity, it's simply not possible for anyone to live beyond about 120 years.
Okay.
The longest recorded lifespan is 122. It's right in line with the biblical limit you see in Genesis 6:3.
So definitely
I want you to live a healthier life, Krista.
Definitely.
But don't count on going past 120.
Okay, very good. Well, I think this really provokes my thinking of these early chapters of Genesis and some of the challenges that my non-Christian friends bring up. More about that in your book, Navigating Genesis, which would be a good resource for people if they want to continue this conversation.
All of chapter 13 focuses on that issue.
Very good. So I want to let everyone know about that. Now we're going over to Jeff, who's talking to Dr. Rana about the question, are Neanderthals human?
Hello, Jeff Zwerink, and welcome again to Give and Take. This is the segment of our show where we look at neat and fascinating scientific discoveries to help you be more confident in the truth of Christianity so that you can share your faith more confidently. Today, I'm joined by my colleague and good friend, Fuzz Rana, and we're going to be looking at the question, are humans and Neanderthals the same or not? Fuzz, good to have you here again today.
Jeff.
So this is something, I think just the idea of Neanderthals, these human-like, human-looking creatures that exist in the fossil record, they just kind of create a lot of interest and confusion. I know that there are people who want to make them look more human, others that look different. So why is it that some people want to have humans and Neanderthals be the same?
Yeah, well, if you look at scientists that are looking at the origin of humanity in evolutionary terms, they have an interest in making Neanderthals, if you will, like us, because it essentially undermines the concept called human exceptionalism. Mm. So in other words, many anthropologists really battle against the idea that somehow human beings are exceptional, that somehow we stand apart, that we're superior to other creatures. And so if Neanderthals can be like us, then that kind of knocks us off of our pedestal, if you will, and makes us just like other creatures that exist on Earth.
So the idea is that we're different, but they're kind of similar. It's just almost a difference of degree, maybe, not of kind, whereas
right.
exceptionalism would make us different in kind, if you will.
That's exactly right. And so the idea would be, from an evolutionary standpoint, many people believe the humans and Neanderthals shared a common ancestor, and that there are two lineages that diverge, mm-hmm. One culminating with Neanderthals, one culminating with humans. So evolutionary biologists don't think of Neanderthals as our direct evolutionary ancestor, but as a side branch, but they argue that they were just like us. And so therefore, that capacity that makes us human probably already existed in the shared ancestor. And so these qualities that make us seemingly stand apart actually are just have their antecedents in this evolutionary history. And so it really represents, I think, a very real challenge to the biblical idea that human beings bear God's image, that we are unique, that we stand apart as the crown of creation from other creatures. And so I think that's really what's at stake.
Okay. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because there are actually other creationists, people like us who would believe that God intervenes and creates the various organisms, who would also want to blur that line between Neanderthals and humanity. What's your assessment of what's going on there?
Yeah, well, in the case of our friends who are young Earth creationists, many of them actually see Neanderthals as essentially a subspecies of humans, that they're just, they are descendants from Adam, just like modern humans are.
So the variations we see would just be part of the variations we see in humanity.
Right. Now, I have a hard time embracing that view, because I think Neanderthals are anatomically different enough from humans that you would consider them separate species. The way they grew and developed from infanthood to adulthood is very different than how modern humans grow and develop. And there's even significant genetic differences that we see. So I think you're justified in viewing Neanderthals as a separate species. Now, at reasons to believe, as old Earth creationists, we would say these clearly are creatures that existed, but we would argue that they were creatures that lacked the image of God. They may have had some measure of intelligence, some emotional capacity.
Obviously, some physical resemblance.
But they also looked rather different from us as well. There's some pronounced differences between humans and Neanderthals.
Well, let's kind of explore that a little bit. What are some of the things that look similar, and then what are some of the things that look different? And ultimately, I'm going to be asking, you know, does it weigh in that they're different or the same? But let's kind of explore those two topics.
Well, I mean, you know, Neanderthals, again, are humanoids. Like, you know, so they have a similar body design and similar body plan. But they tended to be, they tended to possess what's called a hyperpolar body design. They had very, they had barrel-shaped bodies, short limbs, they had long noses, and this was all to allow them to survive under cold climatic conditions.
Okay.
The barrel-shaped body, the shorter limbs helped with heat retention, the larger nasal cavities allowed for cold air to warm up as they breathed it in. So their design was ideally suited for a polar environment versus modern humans that don't display those features to that degree or to that extent.
So it seems like the physical, even though there are physical similarities, there's some marked physical differences.
That's right.
And one of them comes out in brain size. I know that as well, correct?
Yeah. I mean, the Neanderthal skull is very different than ours. For example, they have a very large occipital bun, which is a region at the very base of the skull. They had a more elongated brain case, a pronounced brow ridge. Their faces were not quite as flat as modern humans. Whereas modern humans have a globular skull, our skull is like a globe, as opposed to being elongated. And that has profound significance in terms of brain capacity and brain structure.
So what are some of those differences? Because that seems to be the place where I would expect the most differences between humans and Neanderthals anyway. So let's flesh that
out. Well, I mean, the primary difference when the skull is globular is that the parietal lobe is much larger in humans.
Where's the parietal lobe?
It's this area of the brain.
Okay.
But it's the part of the brain that's involved in the processing that you would need for math and language. It's involved in long-term and short-term or working memory. It plays a key role in hand-eye coordination, things like that. It gives us our sense of self-awareness, a sense of self. It's the part of the brain that goes quiescent during religious experiences, meditation, and prayer. So it's a really significant part of the brain that really separates humans from Neanderthals in terms of capacities that we would possess that Neanderthals wouldn't possess.
Well, and it strikes me that a lot of those capacities are related to our ability to worship things that would be what you would characterize as being made in the image of God.
That's right. I mean, our capacity for symbolism, to formulate language, to manipulate symbols, requires a very large parietal lobe. So that would be an example where we could clearly see cognitive differences between humans and Neanderthals.
Well, thanks, Buzz. I appreciate your comments. You know, when we look at the fossil record, we really do see some amazing creatures that God has put on this earth. And Neanderthals certainly fall into that class. They look a lot like humans, but as we investigate the details, we really do see that Neanderthals are very distinct from humanity. Or actually, I would turn that around. What we see when we look at the fossil record is that humanity is distinct from every creature that we see. We alone have the capacity to worship God. And as we look at the differences between the Neanderthal brains and the human brains, we see just exactly what we would expect if God is the creator of both. You know, I would encourage you to check out Buzz's blog, Differences Between Neanderthals and Human Brains Show Human Exceptionalism, to get more details how you can use this discovery to tell others about how we relate to God.
That does it for us this week on 2819.
We hope that you've been really encouraged by this episode to share your faith with someone new today.
And if you want to support resources like this show, please visit reasons.org/2819.
And don't forget to grab your phone right now and connect with us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at 2819 Show.
Look forward to getting a lot of new likes and hopefully some awesome comments so we can interact with you. Have a great Christmas season, everyone.
Bye.